Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
As sponsor of this podcast, the National Fire Sprinkler Association would like to thank members of the fire service who are on the front lines every day championing fire sprinklers at the grassroots level. We are all truly indebted to your service.
My name is Ed Camo, and this month on Fire Marshal's Corner at firehouse.com, we're going to be talking about catastrophic multiple fatality fires, which are fires that are killing three people or more per incident. And we've had a terrible run of these last year. And unfortunately, as we're recording this, we're going into 2008 with another bad run of them. So we've really put together an excellent panel here to help us take a look at this issue and see what is the story on it and what we can do to probably address it. Joining us today, going down the line here quickly, is Bill Barnard, who's the Maryland State Fire Marshal, Mike Love, who's a division chief and fire marshal with Montgomery County, Richard Taylor, who's a senior research and planning analyst for the Maine State Fire Marshal's Office, Ken Farmer and Kathy Gerstner from the U.S. Fire Administration. So thanks, everybody, for joining us today. And I'm going to start it off here real quickly, just taking a look at it more on the national level before we start looking at it on the different levels of each of these people who are having experience with this whole issue. In 2007, we started looking at what came to call catastrophic multiple fatality fires on an anecdotal basis. There was nobody really tracking it, and it seems that there was a run of them. It's just more anecdotal than anything else. Well, using the clipping services and the wire services and Google and that sort of thing, we started tracking them and collecting the information and posting it on the Internet. And now with 2007 wrapping up, we can kind of give you some final statistics on what we did find. It's not a definitive number. I mean, there very well could be more out there that we just did not catch. But in looking at 2007 complete, we've had 113 fires, which have killed a total of 431 people. If you want to break that down a little bit in terms of adults, that's 197 adults, or 46%, and then 234 children, or 54%. And what I'm defining as an adult is anybody who's 18 or older in taking a look at it. When I graph these out, and you can take a look at it online, the links will be below on the page here. When I graph these out, unquestionably, the months that really pop right out are December, January, February, and March, as the 4 months where just the vast majority of these fires happened. They're happening across the nation. I don't know exactly which states in terms of how many states, but they're all across the country. You can look at the map, too, that's on the website here. It seems to just be hitting everybody, although there is a very strong concentration east of the Mississippi, and there's a real strong concentration as you move up towards the northeast. It's almost along the I-95 corridor that goes between Washington up towards Boston. There just seems to be a real concentration of these. One of the things that really came to mind in taking a look at this is, okay, what are some of the trends? When we're looking at these, what are some of the common factors in these? And again, since we're getting this anecdotally, that was one of the things that was kind of tough to pull together. Who's dying? Why are they dying? What kind of buildings are they dying in? And really, also, I guess kind of the almost a cynical question is this really a problem? In other words, okay, so we've identified these kind of fires happening. Well, is it something for us to really take a look at and really be concerned about? So that's some of the things we're going to be discussing today with the panel here. The first person I'd like to flip it over to right now is going to be Richard Taylor, who is a senior research and planning analyst with the Maine State Fire Marshal's Office, who has really taken a good look at this in terms of how it does relate to the national level in comparison to some of the past fires that we may have seen. So, Richard, if you wouldn't mind filling us in on some of the things you've been observing and taking a look at these fires.
Okay. Well, what I did, Ed, was, first of all, thank you. I went back and I looked at some USFA reports, particularly a report entitled Multiple Fatality Fires Reported to NFERS 1994 to 1996. That was the most encompassing report I found since it put together 3 years' worth of data reported to NFERS. And then I looked at some yearly reports published by the NFPA in which they looked at these fires in a given year, 2002, 2004, 2006. And here's what I found in terms of the, if you will, who, what, when, where, why, and how of these events when comparing and contrasting them to single fatal fires. In terms of the age distribution, the burden of the catastrophic multi-fatality fires appears to be more severe for children than older adults when compared again to single fatality fires. Older adults are more likely to be alone in a fire resulting in a fatality in contrast to children, and that probably explains that to some degree. In terms of gender, we see a diminished disparity in the distribution between male and female victims killed in multiple fatality fires than we see in single fatal fires. There's a higher probability that males will be killed in a single fatal fire than females, as you know. That is not necessarily the case in a multiple fatality fire. In terms of cause, I observe that multiple fatal fires, the leading cause has been heating, followed by arson, and children playing with fire, whereas we see in single fatal fires, it's usually smoking, arson, and heating. All those really are primarily proximate fires, as I call them, or fires where someone's usually directly involved in the ignition of that fire. In terms of the ignition source and form of material first ignited, open flame sources lead the way as the source, with structural components being the material first ignited. The open flame source perhaps could be tied with child fire play or arson, and the structural components first ignited probably relates more to these heating fires. It should be noted that soft goods, i.e. bedding and clothing, followed structural components as the material most often being the first ignited material. In single fatal fires, the leading heat source was, as expected, smoking material, with soft goods leading the way as materials first ignited. When? Fatal fires, single or multiple, are more likely to occur between 12 and 6 a.m., as we all know. A higher proportion of multiple fatal fires appear to occur in the early morning hours in contrast to single fatals. Multiple fatal fires occur less frequently during the day or waking hours of the day. These early morning fatals appear to be resulting from heating in contrast to smoking that we see in those single fatals. In terms of fire fatalities, and you already pointed this out, Ed, multiple fatals or single fatals occur in the winter primarily, in December, January, and February, although, as you pointed out, this year here we saw March beating out, I think it was December. Where? The lounge is found to be the leading area of origin for multiple fatal and single fatal fires, with the lounge and bedroom areas following. However, 35% of multiple fatal fires started in the lounge as opposed to 27% for single fatals.
In terms of a lounge, what would you...
That would be the living room, playroom, an area like that.
Okay, got it.
Okay, as opposed to the kitchen, another function of the bedroom or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
One-third more single fatal fires occurred in the kitchen than multiple fatals. Again, that probably reflects the lower frequency of waking hour multiple fatal fatalities that we do see. Fire fatality is primarily a residential dwelling issue, with roughly 80% occurring in one or two family dwellings and another 17% in apartments. This is true for both single and multiple fatal fires. The population count, I observed this, that I did not find this in the ANFRS USFA report or the NFPA reports I looked at. The population count of the towns in which these events occurred in 2007 was interesting. When I took the census data, I found that the mean population for those 113 fires was approximately 600,000. And I think this is interesting because we frequently hear that fire fatalities in general occur more often in areas where the population is under 2,500. One USFA study on the rural fire problem found that fire deaths rates are 35% higher in rural areas compared to non-rural areas. Bear in mind that the difference between counts and rate, you need to consider that. And there are varying definitions as to what is rural and what is urban. Now, why are these occurring? I've mentioned cause, but under why, I look generally at human activity at the time of the injury and victims' conditions prior to the injury or ignition, if you will. Half of the multiple fatal fire victims were asleep at the time they were killed. and the next largest grouping, around 30%, were attempting to escape. And again, this sleeping activity, of course, reflects the time in which these events occurred, as well as the young age group that are involved here, the young victims. Children frequently are sleeping in those periods of time. Single fatal fire victims were several times more likely to have been bedridden or impaired by alcohol or simply too old to act, in contrast to multiple fatal fire victims. Generally speaking, multiple fatal fires, like single fires, occur more often in homes without working smoke alarms. How? Victims of fires, single or multiple, appear to be killed primarily by a combination of smoke inhalation, asphyxia, and burns. In summary, it should be noted that the USFA studies focused on residential fires for obvious reasons. When you look at the NFPA studies, you get more information on non-residential properties where there have been multiple fatals, and they often discuss transportation-related fires such as big plane crashes, bus accidents, bombing incidents such as the one we saw in Oklahoma City, or the 9/11 attack, those mega events. Now, comparing this to the past recognition of the problem, multiple fatality fires have ironically driven the fire code for both residential and non-residential occupancies. Ironically, it has been the big fires, such as the Triangle Fire, Cotton Club, Station House, and other fires like that, of that kind, that really have fertilized the political soil, if you will, to make regulatory approaches more acceptable to the public at large. There seems to have been, in my own opinion, little focused discussion on residential multi-fatality fires. The 2007 data, when I look at that to frame a problem, generally speaking, the information we collected appears consistent with a few previous studies on the subject I found in the following ways. The fire death count of 431 in 2007 is consistent with the average of 450 per year we saw in the 1994 to 1996 study. The distribution of fatals in terms of age indicates the burden of these fires is more severe for children, unlike single fatal fires. We saw that in this 2007 data. The general difference diminishes as you move from single fires to multiples in terms of age. In 2007, the worst months were February, March, and December, as opposed to December, January, and February that I saw in the 94 to 96 study. 1 year, however, does not establish a trend, but you can still view this as a winter month problem. The time of day for 2007 reflects the 12 a.m. to 6 a.m. pattern we've seen in the past. In terms of cause, we were only able to make that call 13 times of the 113 fires that we looked at in 2007. These fires, however, were those proximate incidents again, with child play, arson, smoking, being leaders. Again, we only identified 13. Out of the 113, we were able to nail down the type of occupancy 30-plus times, or roughly 25% of the time. That small number, however, backs up the hypothesis that this is a residential problem, primarily in one or two family dwellings. We really didn't look at area of origin in 2007 or the activity at the time of death. I know these are things that we're going to be looking at closer in 2008. One question that came to mind that really struck me, having reviewed the USFA reports, Fire in the United States, going back to the 1980s, is the overall, if you look at fire deaths in the United States, it has been declining since the latter 70s, early 80s through to present. I had to ask myself, in looking at this study and at the 2007 data in particular, is that the same for multiple fire fatals? I don't know off the cuff. If it is not, then we have a situation when we're speaking in terms of fire fatality where we're not seeing improvement, which sets us apart from the general thought that we are making progress, which we are generally in terms of fire fatality, but perhaps not in multiple fatal fires. In summary, based on the 94-96 study and others like it in combination with our 2000 data, the problem is one for children in areas with a relatively large population. Because these fires appear to be predominantly proximate, this is a problem that might be best addressed through fire prevention education programs focused on that pre-ignition phase of fires, with regulatory approaches applied to the fewer multiple family dwelling type fires where this does occur as well. We saw that in Baltimore, Chicago over the past year. This proximity issue, as you know, is troublesome to me because there is often some confusion between concepts or programs designed to prevent a fire as opposed to those designed to provide people with information they need to survive a fire. Both are important, but I just think it's always important to separate fire prevention and fire safety education programs from fire prevention and fire safety awareness programs, as well as intervention strategies, which could be important, particularly where you're dealing with children playing with fires. And, of course, we also have the co-development and enforcement strategies. All these are separate and distinct tools the fire service has to use to reduce fires and fire fatalities, but you really need to look closely at the details of these specific problems to decide which approach would work best.
And I think that's really kind of where the rub is. You know, we've all been talking about this collectively offline here and trying to come up with a solution. I mean, you've given a great analysis of it, but now the real problem is to the practitioners out there. Okay, we've got this problem. How do we address it? How do we fix it? And I think one of the things we have to caution people, too, is that, as you mentioned, that the information you just went over is just 1 year, so 1 year does not a trend to make. And I think it gives us a lot of great information, but the big question, too, people are always coming back with, and they're asking me a lot, is, well, is it growing? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? And, you know, quite honestly, we just don't really know, do we? You know, it's something that we just are starting to really take a little closer look at and learn a lot more about. So with that, you know, thanks for that analysis on it, Richard, I'd like to go over to Bill Barnard, the Maryland State Fire Marshal, where they've just had a really bad year of this, haven't you, Bill, these kind of fires?
Yeah, absolutely, Ed. In fact, my research analyst just came in before we got started and let me know that we did have another fatality. It was a single fatality in Baltimore City just before Christmas that she got a report on. So it really knocks us up another notch to 92, which is far above the 60 that we had last year.
And so many of these have been the multiple fatality fires that you've been in the state of Maryland.
That is correct. I mean, last year, unfortunately, we lost 60 of our residents and a total of 56 fatal fires. So you can see there was almost a fatal fire for each one of those fatalities. We only had a couple of fire instances where more than one person perished, and there were none three and above last year. This year, in contrast, we had 92 fatalities and 62 fatal fires. So you can see the number of fatal fires only increased by six, but the fatalities were up in huge numbers, and that's because we had here in Maryland, unfortunately, seven fires where three or more of our residents perished. We noticed that in January. We had a fire up in the northern part of the county in Harford County where three adults and two children perished. And then we had a pretty good gap up until May, and then May, June, July, and August we had multiple fatality fires, and then we had another gap until just last month before Christmas. So again, we're back to, okay, we're looking at statistics. We're going to continue to look at the statistics and looking at cause, we're looking at time of day, and a lot of the things that Richard covered, I could see in our statistics as well. There's no question the time of day issue and the place and all those types of things. And I agree with his assessment, too, that we have to separate some of these programs that we have out there under the bigger umbrella of fire prevention and life safety as well. But in order to be effective with some of these, obviously, we have to have a focus, too. I mean, we can't just be all over the map.
Now, obviously, you can't speak for your peers, but looking at it from the state level, kind of the 20,000-foot level, what sort of things can fire marshals start doing to address this problem? Or is it something that we need to look at just to see if it's an aberration? Did we have one bad year and, you know, next year, hopefully, we're going to go back down again? Or are there things that you feel should start happening now to try to address these issues?
Well, I mean, if we go back and we look at many of these fatal fires, be they a single fatality or multiple fatality, oftentimes smoke alarms are not working, they're not in place, and I'm talking about as high as 50% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge issue. There's no question about it. I know some of the communities here in Maryland have moved ahead with fire sprinkler ordinances, but that's only impacting new construction. Our existing housing stock's going to be here for a long time. We can't forget about that. There's a lot of work that's going to need to be done in that area. Now, we take our data that we gather and do provide it to our partners at the local level, whether it's the Community Volunteer Fire Company or whether it's Baltimore City and the fire department there. So they can use that information to help target what they're involved in some of their educational efforts.
But so much of the education, too, I mean, I know it must be frustrating for those of you out there on the front line of, you know, you educate, but yet these fires still happen because so often, and you mentioned the smoke alarm's missing, it's a case of personal responsibility that sooner or later people do have to take responsibility for their own safety, don't they?
There's no question about that, Ed. They have to take the information that they're provided and act upon it. Again, we use as many partners as we can, and we want to get that one message, multiple voices, depending on what the specific subject area we're speaking of. And we tend to roll different things as we go through the year, depending on what may be a hot topic at the time. It's not always effective because, as we've heard time and time again, fire is something that happens to the other person. It is important that we use the teachable moments. Each and every one of the fatal fires we have here in Maryland, we encourage our partners to get out into the field, reach out into the community around them, and find out what's going on. Do people have smoke alarms? Do they have an escape plan? All these kinds of things that are actionable items for them. And it's amazing how many people, even though there's just been a significant incident in their neighborhood, have not taken their own personal responsibility and acted upon it.
One of the things you had touched upon was residential sprinklers, and you'd mentioned that's for the new housing stock that's coming along, but someday the new housing stock is going to be the old housing stock. So really, that's a program that I know that Maryland's kind of leading the nation in terms of a lot of communities putting in residential sprinkler systems.
Well, I would like to think we are, but that's, again, that's one tool in the toolbox. And as you said, Ed, the existing housing stock didn't exist at one point in time. It had to be built new in 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 25 years down the road. A good example for us was Prince George's County, Maryland, which they've required sprinklers in all of their residential occupancies since 1992. They have not had a single fatality in those structures compared to over 100 fatalities in other structures, residential structures without fire sprinklers. So it's a huge difference.
That just really speaks for itself, right? All within Maryland, all within one state.
One particular county within Maryland.
Yeah, even smaller. Yep. All right. Well, thanks, Bill. Appreciate that perspective from the state fire marshal's point of view. And we're going to be going on a little bit more here with looking at catastrophic multiple fatality fires here on radio@firehouse.com. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. My name is Ed Camo.
Radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Of the 3,000-plus fire deaths each year, tragically, most occur in the place where most people feel the safest, in their own homes. But a practical, cost-effective solution is available: residential fire sprinkler systems. As sponsor of this podcast, the National Fire Sprinkler Association would like to ask every member of the International Code Council to vote in favor of including residential fire sprinkler requirements in the body of the International Residential Code at the upcoming final code hearings in Minneapolis. Residential fire sprinklers are a proven life safety technology whose time has come. Let's get them installed where they will do the most good.
Okay, welcome back to radio@firehouse.com, the Fire Marshal's Corner. And joining us now is Mike Love, who's a division chief and fire marshal with Montgomery County. And we asked Mike to join us because, unfortunately, you've had bad run of these in your community, haven't you, Mike?
Yes, that's true. And in fact, we've had two actual multiple fatal fires that we've certainly classified as catastrophic in our minds, and two others that were almost. And with four, it just really shakes you to the core.
Mm-hmm. You know, is there any commonality you're seeing in these? Is there a common thread, I guess, between them?
I think if there's anything, there's an economic level. That's the most apparent thing. We had one of ours that was an African immigrant family from Cameroon. Another was a long-term Latino family, but well-stable in the community. So you know, neither of those had the same fire cause. So it really comes down to economics.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's interesting, too, and back to Bill for a minute. We were talking about this earlier. In terms of the economic issues, you weren't always seeing that on the state level, though, were you? Because it was kind of cutting across the spectrum, wasn't it?
That's correct, Ed. I mean, in the reports that we get in from the local jurisdictions and or ones that we investigate ourselves, it kind of cuts across the board. So I'm not sure that we can say that each and every time. I know there has been some studies along those lines, however.
Because that's one of the things when Mike and I have been talking about this is, yeah, it seemed to be a socioeconomic issue, and sometimes on the micro scale it is. We're seeing it, you know, the poor urban areas or the rural areas, but also it is an issue that goes across, you know. Maybe you can give us a little bit of detail on some of these fires, Mike, to see what we can learn from them.
Yes. You know, the one fire, I guess our first one, was back in June, and this was a family that was new to this country. They were from Cameroon, which is the western coast of Africa. And this was a single-parent family, which is a commonality. And if you look at the United Kingdom report on some of the things that they're doing over there, they found that oftentimes you'll find single-parent homes are at risk. And this family was not here but maybe a month and had just checked into this apartment. It had a number of small children, three in particular, and one of them was very sick. Mom was not feeling well. We think that there's a possibility that she may have taken some cold medicine. She was up most of the night before, so very tired. She had actually was heating a bottle for the baby, and she had one of these bottle warmers, electric bottle warmers, but had also turned the stove on for unknown reasons. And at some point in time, she set the bottle warmer on top of the stove, not remembering that the stove was on, and we think went back to the bedroom and fell asleep, and the bottle warmer caught on fire, and it was all plastic and extended to the cabinets. The real scary thing about this particular fire is that it was really a relatively small fire involving a galley-type kitchen in an apartment and maybe two of the cabinets completely consumed. Not a great deal of fire, not a whole lot of smoke in the apartment. And the victims were all in the one bedroom, and they were all within 3 foot distance from a window, which was not in any way barred or in any way had extraordinary locking mechanisms, and they were 3 feet from the ground. So here, four people died in an apartment 3 feet away from safety.
And I assume there's no smoke alarm?
Smoke alarm operated, and smoke alarm was present.
Really?
I guess the common problem that we had in both of our multiple fatality fires is that in both cases, the smoke alarms operated, and we still had deaths.
Oh, wow.
And we're very concerned about that.
And I know that's another major issue, too, that's kind of going across the country here. I think another topic for another podcast is the effectiveness of smoke alarms. There are different types of smoke alarms, but you know, we'll touch on that later. One of the things you had mentioned, and also Bill had talked on this too, was about the personnel getting out there to be more in the community and more visible. And you had mentioned the UK, what they're doing over there. Maybe you could talk mm-hmm. on that real quickly.
Yeah, and one of the things that we have done, of course, is always a reactive thing after the fire. We call it actually after the fire. We go around and talk to people, and hopefully with a teaching moment, you have that opportunity to point out some issues. But we all in this industry, Ed, you and I have had this conversation, and Bill and I as well, that we have to be out front of this whole thing, driving with significant efforts. And the UK, reading the report from TriData that Phil Shaman had put together, it's got so much information. I think it's going to take a couple of reads before you really get down to it as to what you can do. But they talk about actually carving out specifically significant amount of time in the firefighters' work schedule and rearrange what work they would have been doing so that they can spend some very dedicated time doing prevention work. And a lot of this work is going to be one-on-one to community members. They're actually doing a very, very intricate approach to risk identification and targeting specific risk levels. And, of course, starting with the most severe risk that's out there. And by doing that, of course, they're putting the most time into the area that's going to get them the most gain. They're actually going to, I'll use the term ignore, but they're going to defer any work on the least risky area, those people who oftentimes come from a higher level of economics and have more training and education already. They'll provide them some information through website and letters or something to that effect, but their most significant efforts are going to go into one-on-one in the community, delivering whatever is necessary, evaluating homes, putting in smoke alarms, teaching people what they need, and in some cases they're even looking and pushing for funding so that they can require sprinklers in the most risky environments. So they're really putting a lot of effort into this.
And I found that fascinating too when I was talking to them over there, that yeah, they're actually going out and installing sprinkler systems. You know, the fire brigades are doing that in the really very high risk areas, which you certainly have never heard of in this country. The fire service going out and installing sprinkler systems, which is a great step.
Well, and you know, and of course, you know, we're working so hard here in the United States to get sprinklers in as our number one choice for managing the risk. And they're really talking about putting in the sprinkler system because they're writing off the fact that they can't change the risk, and so they're going to try to minimize it as much as they can. They're trying many intermediate steps before they get to that point.
And what I find interesting, too, is the emphasis they do put on fire prevention on an organizational level. They've moved fire prevention up to, and in some cases above, organizationally, operations.
Yes.
You know, when you look at the organizational chart, there's fire prevention right up there, equal if not above operations, which is just something that, again, is rather foreign to the fire service in this country.
As it was with them, Ed, they did talk about some pushback and some culture change. In fact, they put the most effort in early on into that culture change, and I think that the leader said, this is what we need to do, and this is where we're going, so let's go.
Back to Bill for a minute here. Is catastrophic multiple fatalities something you're seeing your peers take more interest in and paying more attention to?
Well, I think part of the issue there, Ed, is that they tend to get a lot more media attention. Unfortunately, we still lose so many people, you know, the ones and twos at a time, and it's a flash in the pan. You know, the next day you get a small article, and then it's gone. But if you have one of these catastrophic incidents, it tends to linger with the media much longer. I've certainly noticed that on each and every one of the fires that we dealt with this past year. They've spent a lot more time and emphasis on those fires, looking, okay, what could be done different, the cause. They keep checking back with you day after day, you know, do you have anything else for us yet? Whereas on your fire where one or two persons perish, which to me are just as important, there's very little of that type of attention or follow-up.
Yeah, it does tend to be fleeting.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I will say that we've worked on collectively in trying to impact this situation from a positive standpoint is, from a legislative standpoint, we were fortunate after a three-year battle of passing legislation that's going to require the so-called fire-safe cigarettes be sold here in Maryland, like they are in New York, California, and a couple other states. And, of course, over the next probably 18 months, several other states will be joining New York and California along with us in requiring that, because quite frankly, year after year, the smoking materials have been the number one cause of all types of fire fatalities, including these multiple fatality fires.
And in Kentucky, of all places, you know, a real tobacco state, shall we say, it took one of these incidents where 10 people were killed to really push that one through too. That's a good point that you brought up there.
Well, it goes back to the media attention. That fire received a significant amount of media attention. And I know that Richard mentioned it earlier, these catastrophic fires, he mentioned the Triangle Fire, Beverly Hills Supper Club, and those type of things garner a lot of attention and do move things as far as changing the codes and also legislative changes in either the local level or the state level. One of our counties, for example, after a multiple fatality fire, passed residential sprinkler legislation within a three-month period. Again, it's that emphasis, the media attention that occurs, it doesn't last forever, but it certainly heightened awareness at that point.
Well, that kind of brings us into the next two people we'd really like to talk to, because Ken Farmer, who's a branch chief down there for the prevention and leadership section, and Kathy Gerstner, who's a program specialist down at USFA, have a bunch of resources down there that can really help people in terms of that teachable moment when the media attention is on it. And maybe Ken and Kathy, you can fill us in a little bit on what kind of resources USFA can lend to people like Mike Love and Bill Barnard, who are out there, you know, trying to reach out and educate people on these issues. What sort of resources does USFA have to offer?
Well, I think we have several. Let me first thank Fire Marshal Barnard and Mike Love, Division Chief, and also Richard Taylor for their fine work and what they do. We count them both as friends as well as professionals from the U.S. Fire Administration because of the fine work they do in their states as well as in their local departments. And it's work like that that makes all the difference. I think we have a lot of resources that people may or may not be aware of. The one thing that we do, we have a program called Quick Response where we actually track any fatality that occurs in the country in a civilian. And that's posted on our webpage weekly. Any firefighter in a fire department can check that and see the number of people that are dying in fires. And that's at our webpage is usfa.dhs.gov. And you can go to the citizen link or to the fire safety link, and you'll see most of that material.
And I think the information that Kathy's been posting there is just absolutely invaluable. If you haven't gone there, the Quick Response Program, you know, they're essentially reporting these fires in real time. And you're not getting them all, Kathy, but you're getting a fair amount of them, aren't you?
Yeah, she has done a real good job of getting a lot of those. She is the numbers are picking up, obviously, every day. And we're doing it, as you said earlier when you started the podcast, we're speaking mostly to anecdotal information and getting it from clipping service. So we're not missing many, we don't think, but we are missing some every now and then. So it is a very subjective database at best, but at least it raises awareness and lets people be more informed about what's going on with fire deaths.
And I think we're all, as fire safety professionals, getting a lot of lessons learned out of this. I think, Richard, you know, we certainly need more information, don't we, to really try to take a look at it and analyze these in more in depth in the upcoming year.
Yes, we do. But I think you're heading that way, Ed. If you look at your 2007 spreadsheet and then look at your 2008, you can see the changes there. And I should mention that in the report that I looked at from the USFA on the 94 to 96 multiple fatality fires, they too used media reports in putting that report together, so you're not alone.
Well, sometimes, you know, the media is the quickest and the fastest way we can get this information all together. But, you know, just kind of wrapping up here, Bill, is there anything more you'd like to add to what we've been talking about here today?
Well, I think that... mentioned the materials available through USFA, and we have used those ourselves and referred some of our partners in the particularly in the rural areas to that material to use as part of their educational efforts and informational efforts to get the word out on specific problem areas.
Mike Love, anything you would like to add here as we close out the podcast?
Absolutely. Thanks, Ed. And one of the things you and I have had conversations about is the need to really drill down in the investigation process and treat it like, as the UK has found, and I can't believe it, that I'm reading that after you and I have had the conversation, that you actually look at each fire death and involve, you know, a number of the different social aspects that might have come into play, economics, language, education, all those kind of things probably played a role. And then once you find information like that, you then need to be able to share it back to those people that would have some prevention involvement in it. And in the UK situation, they've even looked at all those different agencies that might have had a contact with somebody. An example was given in the report from TriData that there was one lady who, when they went in to investigate her fire, the social workers that had been working with her for a number of months had noted in logs and those kind of things that she, you know, did experience some sloppy smoking behavior, burned herself and burned different places in her house. And somehow or another, that kind of risk information never really got to the right people to maybe help out in a situation like that. So they're really looking at a whole holistic approach to this and not just the fire department going out and doing one-on-one knock on door, can we check your smoke alarm? So you got to drill down in that investigation and look at all aspects.
Ken, anything you'd like to add as we wrap up the show here?
Yeah, Ed, there's four things, I think. One, the message that clearly comes across both from Richard's work as well as everything that Bill and Mike are working on is having working smoke alarms is our number one issue. Number two is having a working home escape plan. And number three, if you can, encouraging the use and implementation of residential sprinklers. I think that message is pretty clear. Number two, recently in North Carolina, they had a multiple death fire where 7 college students died down on the coast. And as a result of that, they did try to make a change and attempt to change the building code in North Carolina. They had a 7-6 vote or 6-5 vote. It was very close to add residential sprinklers, which unfortunately didn't pass, but raised a lot of awareness in that area.
And I think that was a great example of using that teachable moment. It was a terrible tragedy, but you know, let's use those while the awareness is there and try to get the change that we need to see coming into place. So, yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly what we're looking for.
Right. Well, folks, I really do appreciate you taking the time to join us here today talking about this whole issue of catastrophic multiple fatality fires, which does seem to be one of significant concern in terms of when we look at the numbers. But at the same time, too, it's something that we're just starting to really learn more about and take a closer look at. There's a wealth of information that was given today. If you look on the page below here, you'll see links to the page where we're tracking this. We've got it on mapping. We've got it on a spreadsheet. And a lot of the issues are addressed in here, too. We had a previous podcast about where we talked about, for example, the UK report, the Phil Shinneman report did. If you look at a recent Fire Marshal's Corner, we talked to Phil Hales from the Cheshire Fire and Rescue over in the UK. And also we had an interview with Kathy Gerstner about their quick response program. So if you look on the page below, you'll see a lot of links that will take you to a lot of this information that we threw out there today, because we did indeed throw a lot of information out there. So Richard Taylor, Maine State Fire Marshal's Office, Bill Barnard, Maryland State Fire Marshal, Mike Love, Montgomery County, Ken Farmer, USFA, really appreciate you folks taking the time and joining us today on radio@firehouse.com. My name is Ed Kamau. Stay safe.
Before leaving today's podcast, the National Fire Sprinkler Association asks that you follow the link from their banner ad to information about the facts of including residential fire sprinklers in the body of the IRC.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio. Thank you.